edition of Why Do We Do That? I wanted to continue with dinner etiquette part two. Last time we talked about one part of dinner etiquette, which is my machronim, washing the afterwaters. And today I wanted to deal with another few little things that come up when you're having a meal, different things of, you can call them etiquette. I mean, they're not really based on etiquette, but some of them are, sort of. We'll see. Different things that come up during the meal where you're not supposed to talk, you should pass things in a certain sequence, and so on, and try and look at where did these things come from, why are we doing them, and how do we get some good perspective on what we're doing. So the three things specifically is I wanted to talk about, we know that some point after you wash, before you eat bread, you're not supposed to talk. And it's not exactly clear, as we'll see, when exactly that's supposed to be or how that works and what happens if you start talking. Are you supposed to go wash again, as is common practice in some places? So we'll look at that. The other thing I wanted to look at was passing out challah and also grape juice as a derivative thing. How do you pass it out? And what exactly is involved there? And there's always the discussion, which I've had a million times, that you're not supposed to be polite, and you should drink it, and then you should pass more to other people, even if they think that you're being rude, because that's what you're supposed to do. You should drink it first. So should you pass it out? Should you drink it first? We'll see some issues that relate to passing out challah. And finally, I wanted to talk about the concept of zimun. If you have three people who are eating together, then there's a concept of creating a zimun, of having three people that bench and they add an extra part to the beginning of Birkat HaMazon. And what exactly is that? Where does it come from? So those are the three things I wanted to look at today. We'll see how much of it we get through. If we don't get through everything, then we don't get through everything. But let's start with this issue of washing after bread, or talking after washing for bread. We know that's something that happens. You wash, and then you're not supposed to talk until you start eating. But really, it breaks down into two different issues. There's two big different halachic issues which are at play. One issue is what's called in halacha a hefsek, which is an interruption. An interruption that you do between, usually it's between a bracha and an action. You make a bracha, you're not supposed to have any kind of interruption between when you make the bracha and when you do the action that's associated with the bracha. It's called the hefsek. So we'll see how this plays out. The other issue is called hesech hadat. When you wash your hands, we've talked about washing hands in different contexts. You wash your hand in the morning. Part of the reason is because your hands sort of go and they touch all kinds of things and they can get dirty, and then you need to clean them before you know, if there's something you need to clean your hands for, you have to clean them and make sure, because you don't know where they've been, what they've been touching. You don't pay attention to necessarily, for example, I'm fiddling with this, I just noticed that. So you don't really necessarily notice where your hands, what your hands are doing, and because you're not aware of it, you're not conscious of it, maybe they touch something which requires you to wash your hands. And so there's an issue between washing your hands and eating. The whole point of washing your hands is to prepare your hands for the eating, that you have to be conscious of where your hands are, and so that you're not touching something which is problematic. That's a little bit different than a hefsek. It's different than, you know, the concept of an interruption is much more sharply defined. It's much more serious. So we'll see the distinction between these two things. If we look in the first source, this is a description in the Shulchan Aruch just about, in general, if you make a bracha about not having an interruption, not having a hefsek between making the bracha and whatever you're going to do afterwards. Kol elu habrachot tzarich shelo yafsik bein bracha l'achila. For all of these brachot, we're talking here about brachas on food, you have to be careful not to have any interruption between the bracha and eating, any more than you can help. And the Ramah notes, yoter mikadei dibur. Maybe even if your break, your interruption there is longer than, thank you, is longer than kedei dibor, is longer than an interruption in normal speech, that could be a problem. That's about 2 to 3 seconds. So usually that, you know, doesn't happen between the time when you make a bracha and the time when you do something. But maybe it's an ideal that you're supposed to be reaching for. In source 2, we see the discussion of this concept in Shulchan Aruch, specifically relating to bread. When you make the bracha on bread, yochal miyad velo yasiach bein bracha l'achila. So when you make the bracha on bread, you should eat immediately, and you shouldn't talk between the bracha that you make and the eating. V'imsach tzarich lachzor ulevarech. If you speak in between the bracha and when you eat, then you're supposed to make a bracha again. You have to make another bracha, unless you're talking about something that has some sort of relationship with whatever you made a bracha about. So if you made a bracha on bread, and you need salt, you need something to dip the bread into, you're allowed to say, hey, can you bring me some salt? I forgot the salt inside. Can you bring the salt out? And then you're allowed to say. But otherwise, you should be, if you interrupt with speech, you're supposed to make the bracha again. So these two things, this is really this first issue. That anytime you make you have an action, there has to be a correlation between the bracha and the action. Just from a philosophical level, it makes sense. The bracha is a proclamation that whatever I'm going to do, if you're doing a mitzvah, I'm going to do something now that God commanded me to do. Now I'm going to eat, I'm going to pick up this palm frond, whatever you're going to do, I'm going to sit in this hut, I'm going to do anything. I'm not doing it because I'm a hut enthusiast, I'm doing it because there's a mitzvah, because God commanded me to do something. So you're acting sort of in a way that you're focusing your thoughts towards what you're going to do, and you want to show that there's a continuity between your intention, your focusing of your thoughts on what you're doing, and what you actually do. And it's similar when you make a bracha on food. You're making a proclamation that the idea is that everything belongs to God. I don't have a right to use anything, just out of the blue. But if I show that I recognize that God created this thing, so it turns this eating into an opportunity to have to turn it into kind of religious moment. And we want to have total continuity between that statement, that sort of orientation, and when you actually do the action. So this is true. This is true when you make a bracha before you do something. It's also true when you make a bracha after you do something. When you wash, we wash our hands, so you make the bracha, it's sort of halfway through the process. After you wash your hands, before you dry them, for whatever reason. And the same idea of continuity is true there also. If you start talking between when you wash your hands and you make the bracha, you also break this kind of thing. So this kind of break is a much more severe, the concept of a hefsek, that you speak in between the time when you make the bracha and the time when you complete the action. So this is true in between the washing part and the saying the bracha on the washing, and also in between saying hamotzi, the bracha on the bread, and actually eating the bread. That's when there's a very severe kind of level of not speaking, because you want to have the two things come together. What about after I wash my hands, and now I'm sitting at the table and I'm waiting for the hamotzi to happen? This is not one thing, right? There's two elements happening. I wash my hands, and also we're going to make a bracha on the bread and then eat the bread. So what about that? Is there supposed to be a break there? Can I speak there? Why wouldn't I be able to speak there? They're two separate ideas. So we mentioned this notion of hesech hadat, of distraction. If you look in source 3, it's very short, the Talmud says, Tekef l'natilat yadayim se'uda. Immediately after you do natilat yadayim, immediately after you wash your hands, you're supposed to have the meal. The meal should immediately follow washing the hands. But it's not at all clear what that means. Does that mean something very severe, like what we said before, that you can't speak, you can't say a word, you can't do anything? Does it mean that you should try and have the meal as soon as you can after you wash your hands? It's a little bit more loose, like, because it's important that the two things should come one after another. So if we look in 4 here, we see that the Shulchan Aruch presents both sides, both possibilities. Yesh omrim, there are those who say, she'ein sarich lizaher milhafsik bein netila lahamotzi. You don't have to be careful about having an interruption, a hefsek, between when you wash and when you make the bracha on eating bread. Ve'yesh omrim she'tzarich lizaher v'tov lizaher. And some people say it's important to be careful, and he thinks it's important to be careful. It's good to be careful, rather. And for these purposes, according to this more stringent view, if you've waited longer than the amount of time it takes to walk 22 cubits, which I think is somewhere between 20 and 22 seconds. That may already be too long, and ideally you should not wait that long between washing and doing hamotzi. So we see there are two sides here. One side wants to view this more stringently. It's the same as, and we'll read this, maybe we'll read it in English in the Mishnah Berurah in a second, it's the same as the sort of stringency that you have between when you say a bracha and then you're going to do something afterwards. The other side views this more loosely. It's not such a big deal. You can do other things as long as you're more or less aware of what's going on. So if we look in 5, the Mishnah Berurah says, in terms of the first view, one need not be careful, because what is stated in the Talmud that the meal should immediately follow washing hands, according to this view, means that one should not get involved with some other matter or activity that will distract him, or speak at length, since this brings one to distraction, even if we're talking about Torah. The idea is you have to be conscious of the fact that, first of all, my hands are not going to go somewhere, touch something, which will require me to wash my hands again. And also that I'm, you know, about to start the meal, and so you're conscious of the fact that you're going from washing your hands into the meal. But if one is sitting idly and is not involved in the meantime in any activity, even if he waits for a long time, or if he speaks a little...
Oh, I sit here.
No, I could sit over here. I'd like to look at his hair because he has more than me now.
Here, Howie, sit right
here. Thank you. He can't see me.
What's it here, Howie?
So... So if somebody's sitting idly and they're not doing anything, they're just waiting for the meal to start, even if the person speaks a little or whatever, there's no issue, there's no concern that he's going to be totally distracted from what he's doing. That's this view. So this view puts this, you know, we sort of like everybody's dead silent, depends where you go. People are very, very quiet and they're worried about whatever. This view, and this is what the Mishnah Berurah will say is the basic halacha here, is that, you know, if you're sitting there and you're ready and you're careful with your hands and whatever, and you're speaking a little bit, it's not the absolute end of the world. The second view is more stringent. This is what's in 2 here in Source 5. There are those who say that one ought to be careful, even with merely waiting, as we will say presently, and all the more so, one should not speak in between the washing, that means in between the washing and saying the bracha for the bread, even a small amount of speech, and even words of Torah are considered an interruption for them, and one must take care. Except for matters relating to the meal, which it is permissible to interrupt according to all views. So the interrupt with, according to all views. So this is the idea. You have these two perspectives. One is much more lenient. The other one says basically this is the same issue as making a bracha and then not speaking between making a bracha and doing the action. The Shulchan Aruch says ideally it's good for us to be careful. So you should try and limit the amount of time that elapses between when you are washing and when you end up saying hamotzi, and also to try not to speak at all during that time. But as we see here in 6 here, fundamentally, we don't really hold that way. Fundamentally, the rule of immediacy, which is mentioned in this section, is only ideal, but post facto, after the fact, even if one waited for a long time, or you started talking, you interrupted in between, there's no need to go back and wash hands again, as long as one has not become distracted from paying attention to one's hands in the meantime. So there's this thing which I couldn't really find a source for it, which I grew up like this is what I thought, that if you speak in between, you know, you're sitting down at the table and you say something, it's like a punishment. You have to go back and you wash again and you don't say a bracha, but you have to wash your hands again. So according to the Mishnah Berurah, according to other sources that I found, that's not really true. If you speak, especially if you speak one or two words, if you accidentally say a word or something, so that's fine. The ideal is to try and be quiet and not say anything. If you happen to speak a little bit, you certainly don't have to go to wash. It actually might be the contrary, because it's not that washing has nothing to do, doesn't do anything. Like you're totally fine. You washed, you're ready to eat now, and now you're going to go back to the sink and wash your hands for no reason, because so maybe that would actually be more of a kind of interruption than the word or two that you said accidentally. So that's this idea. And I saw other people relate it to situations where you have children who are smaller and they really can't handle this idea that they're not going to be speaking for 10 minutes while you wait for everyone to come from the table. You have to, like, you know, like, yell at them before and say, you can't say anything, you better not... As long as they're at the table, it's probably fine in terms of teaching them about this idea of continuity. You don't have to, you know, scare them into thinking that if they say something... that they shouldn't, I mean, it sounds like you shouldn't teach them that if they speak, they should go back and wash it.
What about humming? Like, some people have, like they sing a little, like, not words, but this, like, they do, like, a tune or something just because the kids, like, occupy that they don't talk.
Yeah, so it sounds like that's fine. Okay, yeah. It sounds like it's okay. You're not speaking. Yeah, that's the idea. The humming is instead of speaking so that you have to be worried about speaking. It sounds like it's okay. People like it. Why not? It's nice.
So I don't know if I may have missed this. So is the washing of the hands here the same as what we talked about last week, the reasoning behind the washing of the hands?
The reasoning behind this pre-meal washing the hands is a discussion maybe in its own right. It's not the same issue. It sort of has a different basis. But the idea is preparatory. You're washing your hands in preparation for eating bread. That's the goal. It's not really a hygienic thing. It's really, I mean, even though it has that secondary effect, it's really more of a ritual purity thing, but you're washing your hands to get ready for the meal. Yeah. So
when you say that, yeah. there's an action for broth, like,
yeah.
There's an action often, right, associated with, what's that about? Like, what's the, is that like the thing so that you feel more connected?
I mean, in terms of having an... I mean, the actual mitzvah, the commandment, is usually to do some kind of action. The bracha that you say is sort of a preparation to get yourself in the right mindset to recognize that what am I doing now? So you say, like, Baruch Atah Hashem Elokeinu Melech Olam.
What's the ultimate goal of feeling more connected?
Right, the goal is to, you know, so you're not doing things by rote in a sort of, you know, mindless way. You're thinking about what you're doing. And you're identifying, I'm doing this, you know, it's for yourself as well, to a certain extent. I'm doing this not because I really like to eat bread or whatever, because this is also a mitzvah. I'm supposed to eat a meal on Shabbat. That's like, that's part of the idea. So you have that continuity you don't want to break. We have this idea about washing. One thing that emerges from here is this idea of who or when are you supposed to give out the challah and the grape juice and everything that you're giving out. We know if there's a concept that when you make a bracha, you're supposed to try and limit the amount of time between the bracha and when I consume whatever I have. You see here, maybe you shouldn't even wait a tiny little bit. So there, it gives rise to this idea that you're supposed to try and do this as fast as possible. And this leads to a question about sequence. You know, a lot of places there are different kinds of minhagim that have developed about how you're supposed to hand out the challah. We'll talk a little bit about handing it out, but what is the sequence in terms of giving it out to people at the table? So many places, I mean, and what's you know, the person who's making the bracha and it's right in front of him should eat it right away because he has the opportunity to eat very quickly. But then afterwards, what do you do? Do you hand, some people hand it out, my in-laws, they hand it out by age. So it's like, or hand it out like the father-in-law eats it, my mother-in-law has some, and then all the kids get by age. But if they're, you know, passing the plate past me and it's got bread, it's got the challah on it, maybe I want to eat it right now. I don't want to wait to be polite and give it to somebody else. Or maybe just in general, you know, you feel a tendency that you should be polite and give it to other people first and eat later. How exactly does that work? So I saw that there certainly is something to be said about trying to eat the, you know, have the challah as fast as you can because you want to do that. But certainly if there's an order that's being set out, so the description I saw was, or the explanation I saw was, if the plate is passing you and it's meant to go to whoever, that's not challah for you. You know, that's not available to you. You know, it's not like you're like stealing someone else's challah. That's really, you know, it's being sent over the table for them. You can't be so religious that now I'm like, oh, I'm not going to let you do that because I want to eat it as fast as possible. So you should, you know, people, you know, hand it out however they hand it out. It doesn't necessarily stop you from, you know, doing things. It's not improper. People talk about you shouldn't, you know, this is what in yeshiva, you shouldn't be polite, just eat it, pass it afterwards. If people understand that that's true, then that's one thing. People are going to think that you're being exceptionally rude by taking the challah and not passing it around. So maybe again, you know, that wasn't meant for you. It's meant to be handed out in the way which is nice. And there's a similar question which happens in terms of grape juice or wine, whatever you're handing the wine around the table in the little cups. Why we do that is interesting. It seems to have something to do with this idea that since you're making Kiddush, and Kiddush is deeply enmeshed with the concept of drinking, it's alakos, that you say it over wine, you say it over grape juice, something to show its significance, so everyone should try and drink a little bit from the wine as showing that I'm, you know, fully involved in this whole process, as opposed to allowing one person to drink from the wine and do it for everybody. But there also, so you still made a bracha. You made a bracha on the wine, and you want to drink it as fast as possible. And there as well, you have to, you know, use common sense. If you're going to be rude, or if it's meant to be handed out in a certain sequence, it's not for you. You shouldn't be so rude.
And of course, it has to come from the cup that the bracha was made on.
Right, so that's a whole, the sequence there is like a whole complicated thing. Like, do you drink from the cup and pass the cup around? There's a concept called a kos pagum, a cup that has already been drunk from. You're not supposed to drink from it, you know, like, you know, if you're the initial drinking, you're not supposed to drink from it again. So maybe that's not going to help you, so do you pour into a different cup? Do you re-pour into the cup? A lot of people just pour into little, before they drink from it, pour into all kinds of secondary things and then pass it around.
What about pouring back into the bottle and then pouring from the bottle?
Yeah, so some people have intention, or will have like an extra thing of grape juice and have intention for the bracha to work for that as well, and then pour from there.
Do you have to finish that bottle with that sitting, or no, it doesn't matter?
If you have intention for the bracha to work for everything that's at the table, then everything at the table turns into sort of kiddish type of wine. You're allowed to, put water, like a little bit of water or something into it afterwards, and you can reuse it again later. I'm pretty sure. But
so you shouldn't pour before, like put for all the guests at the table, pour first, like one out of the bottle what they want to drink, and then just make kiddush.
So you can do that also, and just have kavana that your bracha is going to work for all of these things, and then it'll work, and you can hand them out instead of.
Like if you put down on the table,
pre-pour the
wine,
cups.
And somebody wants wine, someone wants juice, whatever they want, and then you just make kiddush
sweet
for everybody.
Wine, dry wine, everyone gets right.
Then you don't have to add from the kiddush cup because
everybody's working. You can have intention for your blessing to work for everybody that's at the table.
So it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, and sometimes, I mean, if you did it that way, then you're going to be in the situation of pouring into the cup. A lot of places, everyone gets their own cup of wine, and they still don't make their own kiddush. The one person makes the kiddush for everyone, and then you drink afterwards. So it can work for all of the other wine, grape beverages, which are available.
Since we're on that,
you've been doing that.
No, not to get off topic.
Yeah,
there's also the two. Alternative roads of standing or sitting.
Right.
Right? I'd be neat to know where those came from.
Okay.
Like for a future.
Okay, that's a good one for a future. Standing and sitting in various combinations. Some people stand and sit. And this question, what do you do during Havdalah and what do you do? Okay. Okay. Duly noted. Maybe I'll write it down at the top. Okay. Okay, so this is where this also comes up. You're passing out the grape juice. So again, you want to try and limit that gap, but within reason. That's basically that is this first section. So in terms of talking after washing and trying to limit the amount of space, so we said that there's two issues. One issue is the gap between a bracha and the completion of the action that comes with the bracha. The other issue really is the gap between washing and eating bread, which is really potential, at least at a basic level, less severe, less serious, because it's really just an issue to make sure your hands don't get dirty again. We try and treat it a little bit more carefully, and also try not to speak and whatever, but again, within reason, if you do happen to speak. Or
but here it says 22, the time you get your weight, and under 4, one way the time it takes to walk, 22
yeah.
amount. So you said that's 22 seconds. So you say it's for 22 seconds.
Yeah.
So it's not really possible
to accomplish that. The same way, it's very uncommon in source one that you ever that if you're in this situation, you're going to be able to take a bracha on the bread and eat it within toch kedei dibur, which is roughly the time it takes you to say the words Shalom Alecha Rebbe. which is maybe 3 seconds. So that's an ideal, if you can do it. Actually, this is very hard to do in many circumstances.
Right.
Unless you're like really, like you're washing right next to where you're eating. And some people try and come up, because 22 seconds is not that long. If you have to go out over there, like if I have a sandwich here, not on Shabbos,
right.
Just in a normal situation,
right.
And I have to go out over to wherever the sink is and wash and come back, that's more than 22 seconds. Some people try and get around it by... But the bracha is only completed, right? And you can make the bracha as long as you haven't dried your hands. So some people will wash, come right up to the place where they're going to start eating, then make the bracha and dry your hands. And this timing starts from when you finish drying your hands and then eat. There's other issues with that also. It becomes difficult, but this is an ideal. If you can somehow do it, this is the best, but we recognize that most of the time you can't.
My sees our sukkahs way in the backyard. So to come into the house, we wash, and then we all have to come downstairs, and even open the door would be hefsek, like, because you're touching the door?
I don't think so.
No.
It doesn't sound like that. The door is, like, you know, I don't think so. You can open the door. There's things which make you, you know, required to, if you touch parts of your body which are normally covered, you touch your shoes, you touch something, your hands become actually dirty. So all of those things could require, but touching the door, I think.
But then you have to walk all the way down.
Yeah, so you have to walk. I mean, so, you know, you do the best that you can, but if you can't, nobody's expecting, like, otherwise we would do it and you would know that, like, you'd be washing right at the table and we'd do it right. But that's not... The idea seems to be here that it's an ideal, not
how do they do it
always realized.
In shul, they say Kiddush, and then everybody hears Amen, and they walk through the hallways until we get to the Kiddush.
Right. So that is an interesting other issue called Kiddush B'makom Se'uda. You're supposed to make Kiddush in the same place that you eat. The very short version of that is actually I'm dealing with in my other class that I give during the week. We're dealing in terms of the Gemara. But the very short answer of that is you're allowed to make Kiddush in one place and have intention to eat in a different place in the same building. That's okay, and that gap, that will bridge the gap. And presumably you fulfill the Kiddush. There also, you're supposed to try and eat as fast as possible, but again, I don't think there's an issue of stopping, because the Kiddush is done. The person said Kiddush, they drank from the grape juice, the Kiddush is accomplished for everybody. You're supposed to eat mezonot if you want it to count for you, but, and there also, it's recommended to do it as fast as you can, but it doesn't mean you have to... Not yeah, and again, it doesn't mean that you
that's
have to like elbow someone in the face.
That's why everybody's running to the finish.
I don't know why they were pushing.
That's the reason.
Be careful.
They're all from.
Be careful to do it.
Machmir, all of them.
So
I saw there's a story from I just saw this week from the Chafetz Chaim. He said that he was in the bathhouse somewhere and he saw this person took someone else's water basin in the bathhouse and was using it to wash themselves. So he said, I don't understand. This person came out of the bathhouse much dirtier than they were when they went in. How can you use someone else's, you know? It's whatever, you always have to be careful to, yeah, don't elbow people in the face. okay, so that's important. So that's what we have here. The next thing I wanted to talk about was passing out challah, handing out challah. How exactly, surprisingly, amazingly, there is at least two elements here in terms of to be careful about when you're passing out the challah around the table, aside from this sequence issue. One issue we find is based in this, in a sort of indication we see in this verse in Pasuk in Lamentations, in Eicha, Pirsat Zion Be'adeha, Ein Menachem La. Zion spreads out her hands, there is no one to console her. So if we skip to 8, I really should have done it that way. In 8, we see that the way this is interpreted, there's a question, what does it mean that she spread out her hands? The city, Zion, spread out her hands. So one possibility is you have this image of a person that's terribly upset, and they're mourning, and they're spreading out their hands like they're looking for somewhere, for someone to help them, and nobody's coming to help them. That's one possibility. But the other possibility is we see in 8, Pirsat Zion Be'adeha Dome Le'avel. She'ein lo menachamim v'hu mamtin sha'a o shtayim she'yavo ha-menachamim k'minhago shel olam lifros ha-matzaot le'shevaleim la'vilo she'yochal. It's similar to a person who's in mourning and there are no consolers there. Nobody came to console them. So the person waits an hour or two until consolers come, and like the normal custom, they spread out sheets and they sit on the sheets and they give the mourner food. That's part of the description here in terms of mourning. So there is a concept of giving a mourner food directly. That's a kind of consolation. We know as part of the laws of Avelut, there's a thing called the Sudat Havra'ah, a meal that you have together with the mourners when they come back from the cemetery. It's a central part of the Shiva, and you know, in terms of the practice of the Shiva, to send food, to make sure people have food. It's not just because like they're not organized and they don't have food, so you want to make sure they have food, but there seems to be something more fundamental about offering them food, offering them comfort in that way. So because that's true, if we go to 7, what emerged was a custom, sorry to keep you flipping back and forth, what emerged was a custom that when you give a mourner food, you give it directly into the mourner's hands. Otherwise, you're not supposed to give the food directly into someone's hands, because that would be an indication that maybe they're in mourning. This is what we have here. Katav HaRambam. The Rambam wrote, Habotzeya noten prusa lifnei kol echad ve'echad v'ha'acher notel prusa b'yado. When you're giving out bread, the way they used to do it, is if you're at a meal, I mean, now we do it this way on Shabbos, but they used to do this way all the time, is there'd be one person principally who would be the bread breaker, usually the person in the house. You only have a certain amount of bread, you got to make sure everyone gets enough bread, so they would break up the bread and hand it out to everybody. When this is being done, you should put a piece in front of each person, not directly into their hand, and then that person will pick it up off of the plate, off of the table, wherever it is. The bread breaker should not put the food directly into the bread directly into the hands of the person that's eating, ela im ken haya avel, unless he was a mourner. The katav, it was interesting because, you know, it wasn't totally clear where the source for this was. This midrash I found now because I saw it later, but even in some of the earlier medieval sources, I saw somebody asked, you know, the Rashba was one of his famous medieval commentators, and they wrote to him and asked him where this comes from, and he said, oh, they must have had some source for it. I think I saw one, but I don't remember where it is. I'll write you back if I remember. And so, whatever, it wasn't clear where the source was, but here the Avudraham, who wrote a book which is sort of a comprehensive set of explanations of prayers and minhagim and things like that, he says, Efshar she'atam bazeh mishum she'ne'amar parsat zion be'yadeha v'hu remez leprusat hamotzi, that the words parsat zion be'yadeha, zion spread out her hands, indicates the prusa. It's the word sounds the same of hamotzi, the bread that you give, and as we saw, there's some sort of notion of giving the mourner food. As a result of that, the halacha is, I didn't quote Shulchan Aruch, it's the same language as well, that you shouldn't put bread directly into a person's hand. And this is what, I mean, I think today it's mainly because it's more efficient. People have like a plate, and you cut it up and put it on the plate, and you pass the plate around the table. That's one way of alleviating this issue. The other way of alleviating this issue, which leads to a different issue, which is interesting, is many, and I've seen it in Sephardi households, I think there are others who have this minhag also, is that the person will throw the bread out across the table. So that, which is, that gets around this problem of handing it to a person. It's like, instead of putting it on the table, you throw it around the table. But that leads to a second issue, which is if you look in source 9 here, the Gemara says that you're not supposed to throw bread. It's one of the things you're not supposed to do with bread. Tanu Rabbanan, the sages taught, arba'ad varim ne'amru bepat. 4 things were said about bread. Ein menichin basar chay al hapat. You don't put raw meat on top of bread. Ve'ein ma'avirin kos malei al hapat. You don't, if you have a cup which is very full, it's likely to spill if you're going to move it. You shouldn't move it over bread. Ve'ein zorkin et hapat. You don't throw bread. Ve'ein somchin et hakara bepat. You don't use the bread as a trivet. You know, you put your food, your serving dish on top of it or lean it onto it or something. The operating idea here is that bread is like the staple food and you have to treat it with respect. You have bread, you're not supposed to waste it, potentially put it, you know, put raw meat on it so it's going to be useless, or you know, if you're you have this cup that's full, it's going to spill onto the bread and make it gross and soggy and you won't want to eat it anymore. You're supposed to have respect for the idea that you have food. God gave you this food which you can eat, and don't waste the bread. It's very important. And we see this in the Shulchan Aruch as well. Osa Adam Tzrachav Bepat. A person fulfills their needs, in other words, their needs for sustenance, their physical needs, with bread. V'hane mile delo mamispe, but that's in terms of not doing things that are disgusting, make it disgusting or are disgusting. Aval mide de mamispe, things which are disgusting with bread, you shouldn't do. Therefore, there's a whole list of things you shouldn't do, more than what we've seen before, more than these four things. But he says at the end, Ein zorkin hapat, you're not supposed to throw bread, mishum bizayon ochlim, because it's a disrespect to the food to throw it. And similarly, ukashem, she ein zorkin et hapat, just like you're not supposed to throw bread, kach ein zorkin ochlin hanimasin al yedei zrika. You're not supposed to throw any other food which can become disgusting by means of throwing it. So just imagine if you throw guacamole across the table, that's not useful anymore.
Or you could throw the whole avocado.
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know. I don't know what
happened. I have seen people do where they have little plates and they'll put the bread on the plate and then give it to somebody.
Right. So that is not throw. Yeah, and that's a good way of doing it. If you want to efficiently hand it out, you don't want to hand it to the person's hand, so you put it on the little plate and you hand it out. Like little tiny plates. So that's a cute way of doing it. If you have something that's gross, so you're not supposed to throw it if it becomes gross. But the last point here is, but if something is not going to become gross from throwing it, like, you know, there's one case in shul where we throw food in shul and nobody has a problem with it. Candies! How can you says you're not supposed to throw food. How can you throw candies at the bar mitzvah boy during an ofruf? And they're wrapped, that's true. And also, they don't become disgusting by means of throwing them. That's the last point here. If something doesn't become disgusting, like nuts or like pomegranates, I'm assuming it means pomegranate seeds. Mm-hmm. I think if you throw a pomegranate, it's not going to end well. But pomegranate seeds, that stuff, that you can throw, that's okay. So there is a little bit of
can't throw pomegranate seeds.
You could throw them. I mean, whatever's not going to become gross from throwing it, I don't know what would happen if you threw a pomegranate seed.
If it's not caught, a seed, like I'm thinking of the kids who throw nuts and catch them in their mouth, or grapes.
Or you just throw it across the table to somebody. Yeah. So there seem to be two rules at odds here. One rule is, in general, for food, other than bread, the question is this going to become disgusting now? It's not appropriate to take food and make it disgusting by having a food fight. It's good. You're ready. You want to have a modern application. Can you have a food fight in halacha?
I was thinking the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a very basic, like, yeah, like, don't destroy food. It's not appropriate to make food disgusting and get rid of it and destroy it. So if it's not going to be gross and you can still eat it, then you can toss it across the table. And then it sounds like, and this is maybe, I was trying to figure out where the Sephardi custom comes from, it sounds like bread may be a unit by itself. And bread is fine. If you throw a piece of bread across the table, it's going to be okay, more or less. Right? Sometimes, maybe not, but more, no? What do we think?
But didn't you say also that that's also like manna? Like it's bread
it has
from
a special
manna.
Yeah, so there are some people write about it especially, this is especially bad because it's a mitzvah, it's breadzvah, and it's representative of all these different things, yeah. And how can you now throw it across the table? That's true, and it's granted. But even I'm trying to figure out, there is this custom that many people do to throw the bread across the table. So I'm not sure that the bread gets this. I mean, I've been at tables where they did this. It was still tasted good. Some of the crumbs may have fallen off, but basically it was fine. So it could be that somebody might read this and conclude that we're talking about some kind of bread that becomes gross if you throw it across the table. But if it's bread which doesn't become gross, then it might be okay, the same way you can throw nuts and you can throw pomegranates. The other view, which I saw here, is that we seem to be differentiating. It says you're not allowed to throw bread because it's a disrespect for food, period. Bread is special. And in halacha, we know in general, bread is special. It's the staple food. That's when we wash. That's when we make a special bracha. We have to say Birkat HaMazon at the end. That's food, the central food.
Why bread?
Because that was the staple food that people had to eat. Yeah, I mean, whatever. We may not biologically have evolved to eat this kind of food, but, you know, in terms of historically, that's what people ate. To that, and so that was your staple sustenance. So bread is held in high esteem. Yeah.
So maybe that's why we... it gives you all, like, not to put raw meat on it, to put water.
Right,
water.
Exactly.
Because
right.
It's not like today's bakery. In those days, there was... Yeah, maybe you had a loaf, and that was it.
Right.
So you wouldn't want to waste
that.
You couldn't waste
it. Right. So yeah. to be able to do that with bread is really bad. Yeah. And today we're desensitized because food is so easy to access. There's no problem. But that doesn't mean we should. It's a good thing that we're desensitized.
It
we still
for
have.
Everybody.
Pardon?
True.
That's true.
It isn't for everybody.
That's true. Well, say in the Western world, let's say, or whatever, in parts of the, you know, parts of whatever, there are people today. Thank God, who may have the challenge of being desensitized.
There's
yeah.
another modern spin to this, and that is celiacs and gluten-free. You can't throw bread around the table if you have someone with a gluten allergy.
Oh, that's a
problem. Because what's going to fall off into their
right,
cup or their
plate.
And I have a sister-in-law, and I have friends who they don't just throw to the table. They make passes to each individual person.
Right.
Especially when it's a big table. And they can't do it when she's there.
That's
interesting.
Respectful
of her allergies.
Wow.
That's interesting spin. So it could be that bread is... So this may be the tension here. I'm not sure. I didn't find anybody that explained this minhag of throwing the bread, because it seems to be point blank against what we have here. Maybe the idea is that if it's not going to become gross, then it's okay. And the other side seems to be saying that bread anyhow is different. It's a special kind of food, and you can't throw it, even if it's going to be gross, all the more so if it's the bread from your mitzvah, from Shabbos. So that's an interesting thing to have in mind, that that throwing the bread, you have to find this balance. You're not supposed to put it directly into the person's hand, but you shouldn't throw it to them either, onto the table in front of them. So the little plates or the big plates or some sort of dish is usually what people do. Okay, so that's in terms of passing out the bread. Finally, I wanted to talk about Zimun, not the details, the nitty-gritty halachic details of Zimun, just the sort of theoretical idea of Zimun. Zimun is this notion that at the end of the meal we have to say Birkat HaMazon, we have to say benching in Yiddish, grace after the meal in English, whatever that is. So and as part of that, the way that this happens changes depending on who's present, how many people are there at the meal. So if there's three people there, I don't want to talk about the issue of women zimun, which is an interesting discussion by itself. It's not, at face value clear that there's three women and there aren't three men, then the women should not be making a zimun, or they cannot make a zimun, but that's a different discussion. Anyway, this is not for now, but the idea is that when you have three people together, that transforms this benching into something else. There's an additional component which is added at the beginning. So I wanted to look at is what exactly is that and why is that? Why are we doing that? We have the text at the bottom, which maybe we'll look at the end, but it's certainly in source 11, so the Gemara shows you or discusses the idea that you have to do this. Shlosha sha'achlu ka'achat chayavin lezamein. So three people that ate together, and there's a wealth of discussion about what it means to eat together, and what if you're in a cafeteria, and one person intended to leave, and what if da-da-da, which I don't want to talk about now, but three people that, you know, in a classic sense, let's have lunch together, and they all ate together. Those people are chayavin lezamein. They have to make a zimun. They have to invite each other zimun means to invite each other to say this special thing. Minan emile, how do we know that this is true? So there's a dispute here, and there's two different sources, two different psukim that are quoted here as proof. Amar Rabbi Asi, de Amar Kra, gadlu lehashem iti, uneroma ma shemo yachdav. That is a pasuk from Tehillim, which we'll come back to look at in detail in a couple of minutes. Make, you know, proclaim or make God great with me, and let us exalt his name together. So we'll talk about that. Rabbi Abahu Amar, a different Rabbi Abahu found a different source, Amar Mihacha, he said it from here. This is a source from the Torah, from Devarim. Kishem Hashem Akra, Havu Godel Lelokeinu. When I call out in the name of God, you should proclaim the greatness of God. This is Moshe speaking. It's right at the end of the Torah. There's a poem, Parshat Hazinu. He's saying this poem, which includes the history, a description of the future history of the Jews. And as part of the poem, and part of the preamble, he says, "When I call out in the name of God, you should proclaim the greatness or ascribe greatness unto God." So the question, what is this zimun? What is the nature of it? We know that in normally speaking, in benching, there are three basic brachas and a fourth bracha, which was added later, which constitute the basic idea there. There's we'll talk about the theme in a moment. And this is added on to the beginning. So how do we look at that? Is that just an addition? There's an extra bracha? Is it something else? So if we look in the Rambam seems to assume, very simply, that this is just an extra bracha that you add on to the beginning. In source 12, Shlosha she'achlu, pat ke'echad chayavin levarach birkat hazimun, kodem birkat hamazon. Three people that ate together, they have to make this bracha of the zimun before they make the normal birkat hamazon. So you have, it's like a Lego block, you have birkat hamazon, you attach this thing at the beginning, and that's it, and that's what it is. We'll see that there's another perspective here as well, which emerges a little bit obliquely, but hopefully we can get at it. In source 13, there's a description in the Gemara, Shnaim she'achlu ke'achad, two who ate together, just read in English, one of them can fulfill grace through the blessing of his friend. One of them can fulfill birkat hamazon through the other person's bracha. If he says it out loud, and the other person hears it, that will count for the first person as well. So the question is, what is this teaching us? There's a general rule in brachas, that, I mean, it's a little bit more complicated, but in ideal circumstances, one person is saying the bracha, and I have intention that this is going to count for me as well. So the best thing is to respond, amen. We have a word that you're supposed to say. What if you didn't say anything? You just heard it, and you had intention, and you didn't make any formal indication of this intention. It was just in your head. Will that work or not? And the answer is, it does work. We know that it does work. We hold that it works. So the Gemara here is asking, why do we need a statement that tells us two people that ate together, one of them makes the bracha out loud, it's going to work for his friend? That's not special. We know that. We know that there's a rule that one who hears and does not answer fulfills his obligation. If you just hear someone else say it, you have intention for this to count for you, if kavana, that's effective and you don't need to do anything else. So the answer here we have is Amar Rabbi Zeira Lomar She'ein Birkat HaZimun Beinehem. It's teaching us that even though one person is fulfilling the bracha for his friend, there is no Birkat HaZimun. They don't say the zimun. This doesn't count as a zimun in any sense of the word. What exactly does that mean? That this doesn't, we wouldn't have expected. It's only two people. We know that two people don't make a zimun. So if we look at 14 at Rashi, he says, Lo balu lamdenu, the whole goal of this statement, that one person says it for the other, Ela she'ein tzrichin zimun. We don't require a zimun. Dekevan de'echad yotze bebirkat chavero. Since one of them is has this technical fulfillment through the bracha of his friend, it teaches us that there is no zimun here. Because if there was a zimun, birkat shnehem hi. If there was a zimun, then the one who's reciting, the classic practice was that one person would say the whole benching for everybody else, and that would work for everybody else. Rashi is saying it's not just that one person says it and this counts, everyone has intention and it counts. When you have a zimun, it's a different kind of birkat hamazon. It's sort of like a mini prayer service kind of thing. Instead of having one person by themselves, it becomes like a mini prayer service, and the person that's leading it is saying it for everybody else. So when we're saying here the way that Rashi understands this is that when the Gemara said that one person will fulfill the obligation for the other, technically, through listening and intending, that's not zimun. Zimun means that it's a special, it's a different nature. The whole birkat hamazon, the whole benching takes on a different kind of quality, and it's a different kind of it's a different kind of idea. What I'm saying when we have the three people together than when we have one person by themselves. Sort of clear. So there's two possibilities. Either we're just attaching an extra bracha on. We have our normal benching that I say when I'm alone, and I have the extra bracha which gets, you know, like a Lego block attached on at the beginning. Or there's qualitatively something else going on here. This is like a mini minyan. It's like a mini tefillah. It's like a, you know, three people together. Now this is something better, something totally different than when one person does this by themselves. And the question is, what is going on there? So I thought if we looked at the sources that we saw from before of the description, how do we know that we have to do this? Those two different psukim, those two different verses will show us what the idea is that's going on here. So if we go to 15, we see here, this is the source from Tehillim. The background here is that this is a psalm that King David wrote when he had to run away. His son staged a coup against him and basically took over the kingdom, and he had to leave. And then subsequently he was victorious. It was very unfortunate. There was a civil war. His son ended up being killed against his wishes. He wanted to save him, but in the end, David's kingdom was reinforced, and he managed to come back and he took over the kingdom again. And the psalm is about the story, the experience that he had. LeDavid b'shanato etamo lifnei Avimelech v'gershehu alach. It's a psalm of David when he changes demeanor. What exactly that means before Avimelech, who drove him away. And then he says, I will, what did it say, less? This less. Is what happens. It should say bless. I don't think I will less. Avarcha et Hashem b'chol et. I'll bless God all the time. Tamid tilato b'pi. His praise is constantly in my mouth. B'Hashem titalnel nafshi. My soul will exalt in God, will glory in God. Yishmu anavim v'yismachu. The humble will hear and be happy. And then this verse, Gadlu l'Hashem iti u'neroma ma'ashemo yachdav. Come together with me, other people, and we will ascribe greatness, we'll proclaim the greatness of God together. What's going on here is this is the story of David talking about his own life, about recognition of what God is interacting with his own life. And then, as part of that sequence, he says to other people, whoever he's speaking to, and to the reader, I don't know, Gadlu l'Hashem iti, come and magnify, make the Lord great with me, and we'll exalt his name together. So somebody points out here, the word gadol and the word rome, which are used in this last verse here, Gadlu l'Hashem iti, make God great with me, and neroma mashmo yachdav, have slightly different meanings. Gadol is something which is very big, but it can be comprehended by one person. It's like a very significant, very big thing. Rome usually refers to something lofty. It's beyond human comprehension. It's beyond whatever we can understand, whatever we can comprehend. So the idea, I think, if you're going to look at it this way, is that when you have one person by themselves, the theme, the idea of Birkat HaMazon is that you're recognizing God gives sustenance to the whole universe and to me. There's like sort of concentric circles. If you look at the text, the first bracha is about the sustenance of the universe. The second one is about the fact that God gave Bnei Yisrael the land, Israel, that's where we live. And the third one is about Jerusalem, which is now about rebuilding Jerusalem, but once was not. And the fourth one is an addendum. But those first three, the idea is that you recognize a person by themselves can recognize whatever happened in their own life. Can recognize that God provided food for me in my own life. That's not the extent of what God does. What God does is actually beyond comprehension, and you can't access it. How do we try and access it? By bringing the perspectives of a few different people together. If you have one person saying Birkat HaMazon by themselves, or 10 people individually, they have their own perspective. If we have three people together, once we have that much, so then that's already approaching, we can approach the level of this loftier level of what God actually does that's beyond our comprehension. So that seems to be the idea here. We're trying to access a level of praise, a level of thanks, which sort of exceeds our ability to comprehend, exceeds what each individual can understand in terms of what God's doing for them. That's one kind of perspective. The other possible perspective here comes from this other pasuk, ki shem Hashem ekra havu godel lelokeinu, when I call out in the name of God, then you will prescribe the greatness of God. It's some kind of call and response. I'm going to call out in the name of God, and you have to answer. This is what we have in the last surah, in 16. Amar lehem Moshe l'Israel. Moshe told Israel, v'shash ani mazkir shmo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, atem havu godel lelokeinu. When I call out, when I mention the name of God, you should ascribe greatness to our God. And I wasn't exactly sure how to put this, but I think it's the same kind of idea of having people feed off of each other, of using somebody else's enthusiasm, somebody else's proclamation of the name of God to sort of inspire you, it's a multiplier kind of thing, that someone else inspires you, and then together you sort of create a higher level of religious inspiration, of spiritual inspiration, than you had initially. A lot of times, you see somebody in a serious, you see somebody that's you see somebody expressing themselves religiously, that can be an opening for a person to sort of, do that themselves. So that seems to be the idea of what's going on here. It's not just the way that we've seen an idea of adding an extra bracha that sort of parachutes down into Birkat HaMazon, you're transforming it qualitatively. One person by themselves has a certain level of recognition, a certain level of understanding of what God gave them in their life. Three people's perspectives, and at a certain level it changes again once you get up to 10 people, then you add words in again. 10 people's perspectives already is accessing, like, really giving, not really obviously because we can't, but really giving honor to God in a level which is beyond the comprehension of any individual person. So that's the idea of the Zimun, of three people coming together. And in fact, we see it's this kind of call and response. That's what we do. One person says, let us bless. The other people say, may the name of God be blessed forever. And then, they're called again with the permission of everyone. Let's bless the one from whom we have eaten. Everyone says, blessed is the one from whom we have eaten and by whose goodness we live. And then they proceed into benching. And the idea is that this transforms the experience from something which is just related to my own life to something which relates together with all the people that are there to a sort of higher level of recognition. So that's the idea of the Zimun. So we talked about washing, talking between washing and benching, passing out grape juice and challah, how to pass out the challah, don't throw it, but don't put it in someone's hand, and also this notion of Zimun at the end of the meal.
Okay. Well, that's good.